Welcome to the new RNIB NA podcast, a new monthly podcast from RNIB in Northern Ireland for people affected by sight loss. Listen up, speak up, break down barriers. And you're very welcome to episode 3 of the RNIB NI podcast. Listen up, speak up, break down barriers. That's what we're doing, folks. Listen, I can't believe it's episode 3, and it's wonderful to be back, and I'm so thrilled at the amount of you that seem to be listening, according to our data on Audioboom anyway. Thank you so much indeed for giving your time and subscribing and listening to what we're talking about here on the RNIB NI podcast. Episode 3, this is a little bit more serious, this one. Well, I say serious, it's all about healthcare, really important stuff. Who doesn't need healthcare? And who doesn't need accessible and inclusive healthcare? That's what we're talking about this episode. So we've got two great guests for you to this month. Not one, but two great guests. We're really excited to have Mike Farrar, the Permanent Secretary at the Department of Health, who's calling in to chat to us today. And we've also got Susie Hull from Diabetes UK NI in to speak to us as well, with November being Diabetes Awareness Month, so it's very timely. Of course, none of this would be possible without a partner in crime, if you like. And with me this month, we have Gillian Clifford, the RNIB NI NHS Engagement Manager, who's with me today. Gillian, you're very welcome.
Thank you so much, Joe. It's good to be with you.
Just very quickly, I mean, I think I seem to constantly ask people what they do. But could you maybe tell us a little bit about what Gillian does in RNIB?
Well, what Gillian does is just exactly what it says on the tin, Joe. I work around health and social care, so my job is really to identify issues for blind and partially sighted people with regard to health and social care, and to advocate and lobby on their behalf to identify opportunities to work with colleagues within health and social care to improve outcomes for blind and partially sighted people. And that can be around ophthalmology, obviously, but I'm really, really keen that the work I do is looking at the person holistically. Mm. And so we work on all of the touch points where a person will encounter health and social care, because I'm very keen to make sure that people understand that blind and partially sighted people will interact with health and social care from cradle to grave. And so it's really important that services are accessible for them. And that's my job, is to make sure that that happens to the very best of my ability.
Absolutely, because I mean, it's really important. As you'll hear in this episode, blind and partially sighted people need more than just ophthalmology or...
Absolutely.
Everything to do with health.
Yes.
So we've got a real, I call this a bumper edition coming up today.
Indeed, yes.
We have Mike Farrar, the Permanent Secretary at the Department of Health.
Mm-hmm.
And we've also got Susie Hull from Diabetes UK and NI.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about your thought behind having Mike Farrar on.
I'm absolutely thrilled, first of all, Joe, that the Permanent Secretary has agreed to come on and have a chat with us. We're at a kind of a pivotal point in Northern Ireland. I mean, people will be aware, everybody listening to this will be aware of some of the struggles that health and social care has in Northern Ireland. Historically, there has been underinvestment. We have an emergence from a pandemic. We have workforce issues, and we have an ageing population with increased needs. And so this is really a kind of a pivotal moment where health and social care is looking at what the future looks like in terms of a reset, in terms of looking again at how we do what we do over here. How do we achieve services that work for the community on a local level, but also making sure that patients are cared for in the most appropriate way, in the most timely way, addressing waiting times, which of course are, everybody knows, are just incredibly scary.
Yes.
And so this is an opportunity, I think, to talk to Mike about some of these issues. And I also think, looking specifically at the needs of blind and partially sighted people, it's an opportunity to ask him questions about accessibility, about Encompass, about the MyCare app, about how he sees the future of care in Northern Ireland. And I think it's just a really great opportunity to put some of those questions to him.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, I'm really looking forward to that.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have Susie then on. We're going to listen to Susie later on.
Yes, indeed. I think it's a great chance to hear from Susie about all things diabetes in terms of, you know, what should people be aware of in terms of symptoms, but equally talking about things like diabetic retinopathy and screening, talking about what services Diabetes UK Northern Ireland can provide for people, talk a little bit about partnership working and coming together on some of these issues, but also just raising awareness in general about diabetes, about what people should be aware of, about what they do if they are concerned, if they're experiencing any of the symptoms that I know Susie will be talking about, and what help and support is available to them.
Yeah, well, fantastic. Julia, thank you so much. Well, I'm sure this isn't the last we'll have you on.
Fingers crossed.
I have a funny feeling you'll be back again.
I'll
very
be
soon.
Back again.
Okay, so joining us today on the RNIB NI podcast, we have Permanent Secretary at the Department of Health, Mike Farrer. Mike, you're very, very welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And we're very excited to get to chat with you today. Also with me is my partner in crime this episode, is Gillian Clifford.
Hello, Joe.
How are you doing, Gillian? You all
very
right?
Very well, thank you.
Mike, can I just maybe start? Let's start from the beginning, I suppose. What does a Permanent Secretary at the Department of Health do, I suppose, day to day?
Fantastic first question. So it's actually a dual role, Joe. So I have the privilege, and it really is a privilege, of being the Permanent Secretary in the Department of Health, but also the Chief Executive of the HSC. It's a dual role. Scotland and Wales have dual roles. England has a separate a Permanent Secretary and Chief Executive. And really the job is to set the policy framework, obviously account for our spending. We spend around £8.4 billion of expenditure, and we allocate that through to the HSC, and to ensure that the HSC is providing high-quality services, lives within its means, supports patients when they need it. I guess the bit that is also clear is that we need policy that connects to other government departments and means that health is part of their thinking as well. So I have quite a busy job, Joe, to be frank. There's a lot to do.
It does sound like it, yes.
Mike, can I just ask you, you've obviously worked extensively outside Northern Ireland. Could you maybe tell us what you think we do well in Northern Ireland in terms of health and social care, and what we could maybe learn from other nations and jurisdictions?
Yeah, thanks. And hi, Julie. I really have enjoyed coming to Northern Ireland, and in part because people are so lovely. You are absolutely made to feel welcome here, and that's a great thing. But we have some phenomenal assets, actually, here. In particular, we have invested in a data platform called Encompass, which means that all our providers now are on the same data platform, and that connects to the platform that GPs are on. And that means that we can do population health and then connect that up to people's need for treatment, etc. So that would be a really good example of how Northern Ireland has got really a world-leading data platform. And of course, you know, I used to say that, you know, data nowadays is the new money. It gives you insight. It allows you to use your resources to best effect and target variability and things. So having that data platform is a huge asset in Northern Ireland. And the other thing I quote is the quality of our universities. You know, two fantastic universities. So in terms of academic underpinning for understanding about health and care, we have that. And then the final bit is huge commitment from our staff and our leaders. I think it was described as, and I agree with this, we're small enough to be personal, but big enough to be powerful. Yeah. And that as a country gives us a great opportunity.
Another thing that I wanted to ask you about is accessible health information. And you touched a little bit there on Encompass. And at RNIB, we've worked very closely with the team on making Encompass accessible, and also the MyCare app. From our perspective, accessible health information crosses a massive range of issues for us in terms of people's ability to know when their appointments are, because all too often people still receive letters which they're unable to read. It brings up issues of confidentiality in your healthcare, the ability to consent to treatment, medicine safety, etc. And in Northern Ireland, we don't have an accessible health information standard. I'm just wondering, how do you feel about that issue of accessibility? And also, do you see a potential for us to have a standard in Northern Ireland?
So I think, again, a great question. I think, look, this has been something which for years we've wrestled with and really not done very well. When I say we, I mean health and care systems generally. I think the opportunity is one of new technologies, really, to support people with partial sightedness or blindness in terms of things like the MyCare app being available now that could enable people to be really clear about when their appointments are, to have information about their own health, and that to be provided in a much more accessible way. So I'm an optimist because of technology, but these things don't just happen. And I like your idea of saying, should we commit to a standard and make some promise on this? It's something I'll give real thought to, because I think the technology should allow it if we are mindful that that technology can deliver that. And so we commit to that.
I think that's our hope, certainly at RNIB, is as Encompass progresses, and indeed with MyCare, that people will have more options to receive material in a more accessible format. And I think perhaps at that stage, you could have an operational standard, you could have a standard to hold people to, potentially at that point.
Yeah, well, I think something we'd certainly like to talk to the RNIB about, and see if we can pick that up going forward. I mean, the obvious thing is that that accessibility enables people to get care and treatment when they want, but that then facilitates their contribution to life, you know, to keep jobs and things like that. So there's obviously a return on investment business case there.
Yes, and we'd be delighted to talk to you about that. It would be very negligent of me, I think, if I didn't ask you about waiting times, because obviously the folks that will be listening will be very interested in this issue, and it is a matter of considerable concern and across the communities. And I think that from our perspective, it would be very interesting to hear from you in terms of the elective care centres, whether you feel that they're making progress around areas such as cataracts, but equally in terms of Professor Mark Taylor's appointment, to see what your feelings on that and the reset plan. Yeah. How do you see improvements in waiting times in Northern Ireland?
Yeah, waiting times is a real problem for us here. I mean, as we speak, England is trying to get down to no one waiting longer than 1 year for treatment. Scotland and Wales trying to get down to no one waiting longer than 2 years. We're still trying to get people down to waiting no longer than 4 years. And, of course, we know the outcomes of your care are going to be poorer the longer you wait for care. So this is a big deal, and the programme for government highlighted that. That was a commitment that was made before I arrived. What we have done since I arrived is that we've appointed Mark Taylor as a sort of clinical director. We have actually an excellent team in what we call the SPPG in the Department of Health, who look after the kind of relationships with the HSC, and they've been working hard on this. And we were able to report the week before last that whilst the target for programme for government was 70,000 extra episodes of care, we've managed to do 100,000, so that was good. Now, they're not split evenly across, you know, there are a number of specialties, and we certainly need to look at some of the operations and procedures that relate to people with eye problems. My understanding is we're making some progress, but not in all areas. Mm-hmm. So outpatients and inpatients, we can be variably improving. We need to do this across the board. So from opportunity for early diagnosis and first appointment, all the way through to that next stage of treatment, and hopefully improving eyesight, etc., on a longer time basis, and particularly people's lives as a consequence. So there's more work to do. It is a priority for us. One of the things that I think is interesting is that we do have some quite considerable variability. Mm-hmm. And if you look, for example, at the way that we've now been doing with people waiting for breast assessment, we've done that on the basis that we look at the whole of Northern Ireland and available capacity. And so one of the opportunities for us is to think about, is there a way that we'd obviously give people a choice to wait a little bit longer locally, or to access the first available appointment further afield? And I think that way of thinking about accessing care, obviously we need to support people to be able to arrive at their locations of treatment. But actually, I do think there's some value in looking at this variability. And I think that will help us kind of increase a bit faster than otherwise, looking at every single service.
That's interesting, actually, because it raises an issue that we've had for a while now, which is around things like community transport. Because I know that there has been this suggestion that people should travel if they can in order to receive treatment, as well, obviously, as having that neighbourhood care wherever possible that you should be cared for in the community. What I'm sort of wondering about is whether there is the potential for cross-departmental working on some of these issues, particularly as community transport interfaces with an individual's ability to, for example, attend for their appointment sometime.
Yeah, and look, I think you're making a really important point there about person-centred care, in the sense of, for some people, Whatever their condition, transport is not a problem because they've got neighbours, relatives, people who are very happy to help. For a lot of other people, they don't have that kind of support. And so you need to understand the needs of the individual patients and not assume either that everybody can get to an appointment or would want to. So I think you're making really good points about how do you make sure that the offer of care is personalised and available. But you also make a really important point about our relationship with other government departments. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I came to Northern Ireland saying was that health is horizontal as a, yes, as a spending sort of capability. You know, we can support educational attainment, economic inactivity, avoiding reoffending, all these areas where we're looking to support other government departments. But the something for something deal there about health being horizontal is that those other government departments recognise how they can help people sustain health. And as I often say, you know, well-being is about somewhere to live, someone to love, something to do. And those three things are pretty much out with the gift of most health providers. Mm-hmm. You need to work with partners. So if we can get that working well, I honestly feel that people in Northern Ireland, whatever their problem, would really benefit from that kind of cross-government working.
Yes. That's, I think, a very, very good point there about that idea of partnership working. It's something that I think our NIB, we pride ourselves on. I mean, our ECLOs work very closely with their sensory support team colleagues across the trust areas, for example, and we're very much involved in Waiting Well. And I'm just wondering, how do you feel, or what role do you feel the voluntary and community sector in Northern Ireland has in delivering against some of the objectives, for example, of the reset plans?
Yeah, I'm a huge believer in the role that the voluntary sector can play, and the non-statutory sector, really. It's a bit of a misnomer to say it's voluntary, and the RNIB are...
Indeed.
Sorry, Joe. Pay award in June now. Look, the real value, I think, that people like RNIB is that you have this direct relationship with people themselves in a non sort of power sort of orientated way, because sometimes people, you know, they're very grateful for services, but it can feel like you're not always the partner in care that you really should be. Mm-hmm. And what we see time and time again in all areas, and I think eye care, eyesight is a very, really good example, because I would say largely the role that RNIB plays, is that where you have people talking to other people with similar problems facilitated through the voluntary sector, people with expertise in particularly helping people manage their lives, not necessarily, although you do provide wonderful insights into care and treatment, it's that support for people in leading lives that really sort of makes a huge difference. And we've seen time and time again, if you look at, for example, there was a famous example in England called the Wigan Deal, mm-hmm, where the council said, look, if we... we'll keep your council tax down if you can, you know, sort of work to support yourselves a little more. And in order to support you, we will fund the voluntary sector at a higher rate. So community groups, peer groups, online and physical, you know, just were providing this fantastic support for people. And that council ended up underspending its social care budget. And this isn't trying to get things on the cheap, by the way. This is something that people in Wigan really valued. You know, they got better service, less expense, and actually we were all getting better outcomes. So I'm a huge believer in working with the voluntary sector, and we've put that at the very first pillar of the reset plan. You can describe it under the prevention heading, but it's really helping people to help themselves and to help others in a community setting, but supported, not dominated by the state support and finance that we could put in. Yes. And that's the other thing, is sometimes the voluntary sector has really been less effective as it could be, because the state gives it money and then it requires it to report constantly on KPIs to continue to bid for its next funding. And we should just be better at dealing with that. We should be able to, you know, produce the right financial flow on a sustained basis and not have everybody sort of like monitored to death, really.
Yes, I mean, I think certainly that would be very, very much inconsistent with our own thoughts, because I think that the voluntary and community sector brings a lot to the table. I mean, for example, some of the work that we're doing at the moment with iCare We Care, partnering up with a public health agency in the Northern Ireland iCare Network, part of that is about addressing health inequalities. And I think the voluntary and community sector are almost uniquely placed to address some of those things, because they're on the ground working in communities. They see on a day and daily basis basis what need looks like in those communities.
Yeah, and I really commend that program. And if anybody listening hasn't heard of it, then it's a fantastic program. I think it speaks volumes about what can be done. And it's structured and it has some sort of like clear sort of ways of helping people. And I think that's, you mentioned before, sadly, we do have longer waiting times than we'd really like. But whilst waiting, you can get that care support and be managing that. And I think that's a great example of how the voluntary sector really makes a big contribution. And I'm really pleased when I heard about it at first that our public health agency was a strong supporter of that.
Mm-hmm. Can I also ask you, do you have any messages to the folks that are listening at the moment, particularly around winter pressures? People will be hearing about this on the news, I would imagine, quite a bit now. And also we're hearing at time of recording, there are issues currently around the workforce and pay, etc. Is there a message that you would have to the community in terms of how they can look after themselves in some respects during this winter period?
Sure. I mean, the first thing to say is it's very difficult this year. The budget we have available we started here with a £600 million deficit on an £8.4 billion budget. And I don't want to blind people with the maths, but that's having to make something like between 7 and 8% efficiency savings just to carry on. Mm-hmm. And obviously, pay, we would have ordinarily probably been able to put resource into additional winter support. And so that's a bit constrained. We are putting some additional resources in there, but that's in the natural course of building capacity. But this is a tough year for Northern Ireland, and that's why we've talked about the reset being so important, because we want to move this forward to use our money better. Mm-hmm. It's not that we don't have money. We do have money, but the way it's committed isn't getting the best value. And so the reset is about trying to get more value. Mm-hmm. Speaking specifically to your point about winter, there are lots of things that can be done. If you're eligible, vaccination is incredibly helpful to the community. If you have repeat prescriptions, making sure that you've got those sorted, because, you know, when it comes to the holiday periods during the winter months, you know, you can be slightly caught out there, and it's really helpful if you can think about that. Also, trying to take care of yourself just generally. I mean, that would be, that's kind of advice to us all.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, indeed.
Yes, yes, indeed.
And it always amuses me. Well, it doesn't amuse me. I need to address it. But a lot of people get very concerned about their access to hospital care, when actually they'd prefer never to need it. They do want it when we do need it, obviously, which is why they're concerned about it. But most people want to stay away from our doors and whatever we can do. And I know you give a lot of advice as well, and that's very, very gratefully received, I think. Yeah.
Can I also ask you, coming out of COVID, although obviously COVID is still moving around us, but coming out of that particularly difficult period we had, one of the things that we were reflecting on was the experience of blind and partially sighted people during that time and their involvement in the future in emergency planning. How do you feel about that? Because certainly some of the things that we encountered during COVID, for example, the COVID passports, where people were being asked to take a selfie, for example, and they had difficulty in verifying who they were, etc. And also some of the messaging around staying 6 feet apart, which is extremely difficult for someone who's blind or partially sighted to do successfully. Do you think there is a role for ensuring that people with a range of disabilities, including physical and sensory disabilities and learning disabilities, involving them in emergency planning going forward?
Yeah, I think it's an absolutely fundamental learning point from COVID. It's interesting, as we speak this week, we're involved in something called Operation Pegasus, which is a six-day simulation of a new pandemic, in a sense. It's a different one to COVID, which across all four nations of the United Kingdom, we are effectively planning together and trying to learn the lessons from COVID in terms of dealing with the new virus. And one of the things that is key to that is the involvement of people themselves. Mm-hmm. More generally in planning, and also about how do we really target people with particular need. Mm-hmm. And this was one of the things that we had to look to communities themselves to identify people with need and particular needs, and the state wasn't as aware as it might be. Mm. I mentioned our data platforms, and without this being a big brother, I would hope that in future we'd have a much clearer understanding of people who, you know, might have those needs, and therefore in advance of any kind of problems, you would be involving those people in planning, and that's a very, very sensible thing to do. And I'm hoping that as we're doing Operation Pegasus, we're being able to demonstrate that we're doing things better and differently. Now, it is a bit of a simulation that starts with the panic rather than starts with the planning, but your point is really well made.
I think it's quite difficult, because I think at that particular time, I remember all that quite vividly. I'm sure other listeners do as well. But you kind of felt that sort of like the government agencies weren't thinking about us. Obviously, that it wasn't like that, but you know, that's how it felt, I suppose.
I mean, I'll just take that one on the chin, because I think that is true. What I think did happen, which people actually lament the fact that it doesn't now, is that citizens, neighbours rallied round in communities, and you know, if the state wasn't aware of someone who might be partially sighted or blind living in a street, neighbours were, and you saw this remarkable, you know, can we do your shopping? Is there anything that you need us to do? Are there any people who need to know about where you are? And that spirit, that kind of sense, is something that not only should we build that into thinking about managing future pandemics, but what can we do to foster that as an ongoing way in which we think about our own health and care and citizens support each other?
Yes, Mike, in terms of screening services, for example, one of the issues that we would be concerned about, it goes back to accessibility, is the ability of blind and partially sighted people to fully participate. For example, we know that there are issues with bile cancer screening and the FIT test, for example. And often we hear, and I'm not just speaking of our bile cancer colleagues who've done a great deal of work with us on this, but often we hear, you know, get a friend to do it, get a friend to help you with it. And obviously there are certain types of things you would not want to ask a friend to help you with. So in terms of the accessibility of those kind of vital services, which can make the difference between you being diagnosed at a very early stage and being diagnosed much later with all of the resulting complications and outcomes, can you maybe say what you think about perhaps improving that kind of aspect of the services?
It's a great point. I've never really been sort of presented so graphically and immediately with the challenge of that. And I mean, there's a starting point, which is the mindset about when people design those tests and those screening processes, do they actually understand the range of people's needs and conditions? And there's a principle there that says that irrespective of what condition you might have around your eyes, you deserve every single bit of treatment and support and screening and prevention that anybody else has. So sometimes if you have a visible condition or disability, you can be seen only as that, and your other healthcare needs are sort of seen as some subsidiary. I think there's a mindset issue there about, do we really, really believe that we're providing the best support? What you could do with a FIT test, I would leave that to the experts to sort of say, how could you create the equipment which is suitable for someone who is partially sighted? I think it's a really interesting point, but it comes back to the mindset about when we design these things, do we understand the variability of people's needs, individual human beings and what they need? And of course, it comes back to this idea of person-centred care. Start with the person, because, you know, even within the partially sighted community, there's variability, there's massive heterogeneity of people. Yes. I think that's a word. you know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah, it's amazing, though, how much public health messaging is predicated on sight. Because particularly around cancers, the number of times that you'll get a message saying, look out for blood in your urine or blood in your stools or whatever.
And it is coloration of this, that and the other.
Look out for the change of the colour or shape of a mole, which becomes extremely difficult.
Just on that that area of activity, I did a couple of years ago spend some time in Japan. I was doing some work around trying to get drug pricing right for an older population because they have a rising older population. But the thing I took back from that was the technological advance of the toilet to be able to analyse.
They have some spectacular toilets in Japan.
So we might, in some years' time, have a technological solution to the question of looking for discoloration, etc., or chemicals in our...
Indeed.
Advancements in technology.
What a wonderful position to end on. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, goodness.
Yes, indeed.
Forgive us, our listeners. So, Mike, we never let any of our guests go without asking the same question to all our guests, and that is, if you had a magic wand and in your hand right now, which would be a wonderful thing, I know, but if you did, what one thing would you do which would significantly benefit blind and partially sighted people?
So, this is when I would get very personal about a commitment on my part. And I haven't mentioned, but my sister actually is partially sighted. She had dry macular degeneration in her late 40s, early 50s, and has managed. And by the way, the RNAB have been a great supporter in terms of her care. And so I have... a sense of critic on my shoulder who tells me about what things are going well and not. And my magic wand would be to make our approach to eye care, all the way from prevention, management of conditions, all the way through to dealing with the more profound end of condition, that actually our services in Northern Ireland were really fit for my sister. And she could be proud of what I had done to make a contribution to improve them whilst I'm here in Northern Ireland. And I think the biggest things that we could do, and I know it's a magic wand and I'm only allowed one, but I'm just going to pick something that we talked about before, which was really working with organisations like yourselves to understand need and direct the resources to the places that would make the best impact on people's lives. And I'm sure were my sister to live in Belfast, she'd be pleased if I could do something like that.
Yeah, because I think probably one of the biggest things we hear, Gillian, from the community would be about access to the written, like appointment letters and you know, any kind of information that comes from the health department.
Yeah, I think, Joe, so I have a CDIO, which, you know, we're wonderful at letters, aren't we? Chief Digital Information Officer, man called Paul Rice. He's responsible for not just the Encompass programme, but all our approaches to digital and data. He's also leading for me on innovation in life sciences. So that would include things like some of the oversight of some of the research and things. Mm-hmm. And he would be a great candidate for your next grilling.
Oh.
Your next grilling.
That sounds good.
In this slot, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You heard it here first, folks.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mike, thank you so much indeed for your time this morning. And you're welcome back anytime. I could talk with you all day long.
That's very kind. Well, listen, what we should do is arrange this, if I'm still around in a year's time, and say, what difference have we made? And I'm sure that we'll still be frustrated about some things, but hopefully we'll have moved one or two things forward.
That would be great. Yeah.
That'd be
really
super.
Like that,
okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you,
Mike. Pleasure. Take care.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Okay, joining us now on the RNIB NI podcast, we've got Susie Hull, the Healthcare Engagement Manager with Diabetes UK NI. Susie, you're very welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
So I suppose we're going to have a little conversation, and with November being Diabetes Awareness Month, I suppose first things first, tell us a little bit about Diabetes UK and I and what you guys do in Northern Ireland here.
Yeah, so I'll kind of start off maybe a bit more UK-wide. So Diabetes UK is the largest UK-wide charity for diabetes. And then here in Northern Ireland, we have a team of about 11 of us now, working locally to provide the support for people living with diabetes. We have an office base down in Lisburn, for anybody who's around. And you will also then see a lot of the team out and about as well across events and kind of communities and sessions that we run. Overall, Diabetes UK raises awareness and provides support for people living with or at risk of or caring for all types of diabetes. Our work, though, is carried out thanks to funding that's generated by amazing fundraisers, donations and legacies from taking part in kind of one of our challenges to running your own events and stuff. The work that we do is only made possible by the people out there who support us. And then probably a wee bit of Northern Ireland context for you. So at the minute, we have about 118,000 people living with diabetes in Northern Ireland, and then 82,000 people living with pre-diabetes. And that's just that kind of stage before you would have a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes. We are the third most prevalent condition in Northern Ireland. Yes, so Diabetes UK fight for a world where diabetes can do no harm. And here in Northern Ireland, we're trying to do that across the whole of the region. It can be really complex, it can be challenging, and it can be really relentless to live with diabetes. It requires daily decisions, management decisions, all of that to ensure people live well. But there's stacks of stuff that people have to consider, including lots of checks and lots of management decisions every day.
Susie, you've talk there a little bit about the reality of day-to-day living for people with diabetes. It might be helpful just to let people know, what are the signs and symptoms of diabetes? What should people be looking out for in terms of this condition?
So we talk about the four T's, and those are the signs and symptoms of diabetes. There are others, but four T's are the main ones. And that is, you can be feeling much more tired than usual. You can be thirsty, and it's a real unquenchable thirst. Most people would talk about just not being able to quench that thirst when they're taking a drink. You can be thinner and you can be going to the toilet more often. So those are the symptoms for type 1 diabetes. Those typically come on fairly quickly. It can be a matter of days or weeks. But for type 2 diabetes, that can be a longer stretch. So it can come on much more gradually across years. And sometimes people don't really know that they're living with diabetes. It can be a blood test that's done for some other reason. And you know, we would always say, if you're having any of those symptoms, just go and get them checked out and go and ask for GP assistance to get your bloods done and see what's going on. But yeah, understanding sometimes your risk factor of diabetes, things like your family history, your ethnicity, living with overweight or obesity, things like that are all risk factors. They're not the only ones, but they are some of the contributing factors for the potential of developing type 2 diabetes. Type 1 diabetes is a little less about risk factor, and it isn't always, probably one of the myths is that it isn't always in children. It can develop at any point in life.
That's a great question about myths. There's a lot, especially in modern, like, we all know TikTok and YouTube just full of people who claim to be so-called experts in this, that and the other. And they seem to have this attitude, you know, that diabetes is, if you had too much sugar or whatever, you know, all these different kind of myths. Is there others that you've come across? Or?
Oh, absolutely. One of the big myths, you mentioned sugar there, we get quite a lot of comments, and also misunderstanding then if you have diabetes potentially and haven't been given some information, advice and things like that, that you can't have sugar or that sugar is going to cause you diabetes. There's so much around the sugar. One of the other ones that we would get quite often is that type 2 diabetes is mild. You know, and I mentioned there a while ago that diabetes is relentless. It's complex, it's challenging. So it is, and that's all types of diabetes. We actually, there's our World Diabetes Day campaign this year is Strike Out Stigma, and there is a lot of stigma related to all types of diabetes, and a lot of that comes from myths and misconceptions, but I suppose there are lots of them. And what we would say is that if you're at all unsure, our website is there, our helpline is there, you can contact us at any point, and your team, your clinical team, is also there to support you. No question is a stupid question, you know, and just because you've heard something, check it out, ask the question and see, is that how it actually is?
Susie, diabetes can have an impact on an individual's sight, and some people with the condition may develop diabetic retinopathy. Can you tell us a little bit about that and the importance of attending for screening?
Yes, so I mentioned there a while ago that we as part of living with diabetes, you have checks that you'll receive. And there's about 9 of those that you will receive on a yearly or 2 yearly basis. Just depends on your risk factors and your condition itself. But one of those, as you mentioned, is eye checks. So it is, and it's called eye screening. So people living with diabetes should have a diabetes eye check or like eye screening as part of their diabetes checks. You get the screening because obviously, as you mentioned, Gillian, you can lead to eye complications, including diabetic retinopathy. Yes. So we would always say if you're invited to the screening appointment, please go. Those diabetic eye screening checks are different to what an ordinary optician will do. Mm-hmm. So they're not a normal sight test. Mm-hmm. It's because there's photos taken kind of your eyes and kind of an assessment done of your risk level of retinopathy. And then they can gather evidence over several years to understand, is that developing or changing in your eyesight? So we would always say, please go to your screening appointment. They're really important. They are a preventative element.
Yes.
So they are. Mm-hmm. And they can pick up signs and symptoms very early if you're attending those appointments. They also would say, so now, if you have a really low risk, you might not be invited back for a couple of years to your screening appointment. Right. And that's absolutely fine. It's evidence-based. So it is. But they also say that if there's any changes to your sight in that 2 year, do not be afraid to pick up the phone and ask to see somebody. Go and speak to your own optician. Go and ask a doctor. Seek advice and guidance if you're noticing sight changes there, because they are really important.
Yes.
But yes, eye screening can be up to every 2 years, but it may well be less than that, depending on your risk level, and that will be discussed with you, with your clinician, and your results.
So tell me a little bit about the services and support that Diabetes UK and I can offer here in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, so this is where I go off on one, probably.
That's
so
okay,
it is,
you're allowed
so,
to.
You've got so many. So we are. How long have we got?
I'll stop you after an hour.
Okay, you stop me when you need to. So I will kind of run through again. We have kind of offers that are UK-wide as well as on a local level. So as I mentioned, our website is there. It has a wealth of information. It is so much. I don't know how it contains so much. It's in a bit like yourselves, probably. On the RNIB website.
Yeah.
And what we would say to people is the search function is really useful. So if you just have something, you can go on, there's website information there. And we would have some of our resources are available to order online to your home, but they're available in downloadable options as well. We have, again, on our website, we have a learning zone. So this is a self-management platform for people living with diabetes. And you can go on and you can register. It's personalised to you. So it asks you what type of diabetes, how you manage it, and all the information then that comes to you is personalised to you. I mentioned we have a helpline number, and I am going to look at my notes for this one because I will never remember it offhand. So it is 0345 123 2399. You can phone that anytime between Monday to Friday, 9 to 6 o'clock. And you can also email them at helpline@diabetes.org.uk. They are available for any question that you have related to diabetes, and if they don't know, they'll come back to you. So they will. We also have an online forum, which is moderated, so it is, but any question that you have related to diabetes, stick it on there. If the answer's not already on there, somebody's going to get back to you. It's just another way of engaging with people and finding those answers that you're maybe not sure, maybe afraid to ask the question to somebody out loud. We then locally, we have what are called Live Well Hubs. So if you want to go along and you want to speak to somebody or chat with people who also live with diabetes, our Live Well Hubs are our new community model. So they're based in communities across Northern Ireland. We have about 7 at this point. We have just launched our 7th one there, and we will have another few of those over the course of the project starting up in Northern Ireland. You can get the locations on the website, you can contact the team, or you can follow us on social media at Diabetes UK NI, and you'll get the locations and the dates and the times and stuff for that, so you can. We would run some online sessions, so these again would be signposted or made available online, and the information would go up on our social media, so it would, and we'd try and advertise as wide as we can. Some are held UK wide, some are held more locally, and they're just on different topics around diabetes. Similar to the Live Well Hubs, where we run the sessions based on kind of things like a dietitian coming in, or a nurse or a doctor, somebody you might see as part of your team, but also then community supports, people like yourselves coming in to discuss about the services that are available to you and an offer to you. We then also run some events, and again I come back to just check us out on social media, contact the team. We do run a range of events for all types of diabetes, but that varies across the year, and we'll advertise those as they come up. And they're everything, you know, we continue to hold family events where other families get to come along and come together and meet each other, and it's lovely, to other types of diabetes being supported through events. You will also see us at health fairs, information sessions, all of those kind of things. And whilst we will go out and search for them if we need to, please get in touch if people are hosting anything that they think it might be useful to have us along to. Contact the team and we'll do our best to get there.
That's a terrific range of helps and supports, Susie. And can I just ask, if anyone is experiencing any of the symptoms that you talked about earlier on, what would be your recommendation for them to do as a first step for them to take?
Visit your GP. So your GP will do a blood test. So they will, and they'll give you an answer to something called an HbA1c. And that's your long-term blood sugar measurement. So it is. They'll be able to explain the result. So they will, because your result will vary. Everybody's will be different. So it will. So they'll be able to discuss your result. And as I mentioned, you could be in a what is called normal category, or you could be in a pre-diabetes category, or you could be into a diabetes category. If those symptoms, as I mentioned earlier, the four T's, if those are coming on suddenly, we do say to seek medical attention as quickly as you need it, and whether that's your GP or through some other means. If you're noticing them coming on really quickly, that can be an emergency situation. Or if you see them coming on in your child, that can be an emergency situation. So please do seek it out and support and assistance. But yes, it will come by one blood test. Potentially two if symptoms aren't there, but if you're experiencing symptoms and go, it may just be one blood test that you need. But that's a discussion with your GP to kind of understand what that means for you at that time.
So Susie, nobody gets out of our studio without this question that we ask everybody, all our guests. And if you had a magic wand in your hand today, what one thing would you do to make life a bit better for blind and partially sighted people?
Okay, I think it's a really, really hard question to answer one thing. You know, like,
it's a tricky one.
You know, and as I was thinking, because I knew you were going to ask me something like that. So as I was thinking, you know, I think information, you know, knowledge is key for people to understand their condition, understand what's going on with them, but also for them to be self-advocates. And for them to make informed choices about their lives and their healthcare. I think that comes with information, it comes with support and guidance. But, you know, for me, information starts at a general public level. It starts before you ever have diabetes. Understand, you know, we talked about stigma and stuff there too. A general understanding and awareness of diabetes for a general public, but then also information when you need it during your diagnosis. You know, as early as possible, but meeting you where you need it. Because you may also have other complexities, things like partial sighted or blind. You know, you could have other complication and complexities to add into it that you need to consider how much information you get and in what format. But yeah, I think information supports you and your health. And you know, you can get it from a wide variety of sources. Obviously, I've listed a whole load of sources of information from us, but we're not the only ones. And you may find that you get it from other people living with diabetes. I've mentioned our hubs and stuff there. You can come along and kind of speak to other people, because it's a real good source of support as well, not just information.
I think it's a massive thread that runs through a lot of our conversations on this podcast is sharing of information and access to information.
It is. Yep. There's no doubt about it. Knowledge is power. No question.
Yeah.
And it gives you the power to make your own decisions.
It does.
Mm-hmm. It's not somebody else making decisions on your behalf for mm-hmm. your health.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Susie, thank you so much indeed for coming in. I've really enjoyed this conversation today.
Thank you. Thank you, Susie, so much for having me.
Before I let you go, can I just get you to give me that helpline number again?
Yes, you can indeed. So you can contact via phone at 0345 123 2399, or you can contact via email at helpline@diabetes.org.uk.
Okay, that just about brings us to the end of this edition of the RNA BNI podcast, episode number 3. I hope you've enjoyed it. My thanks, as always, to our guest, Permanent Secretary Mike Farrer at the Department of Health, Susie Hull from Diabetes UK and I. And of course, this month we've been joined by Gillian Clifford, who's our NHS Engagement Manager here at RNAB. Thank you so much, all of you guys. Just a couple of quick announcements before I go. We've got on the 18th of November, we have an engagement session from the team behind the MyCare app. That's the digital health records app that Mike Farrer refers to in his interview. The team are coming down to the RNAB offices here on Gloucester Street, Belfast. They're going to spend a couple of hours explaining the benefits of MyCare, taking you guys through, you know, how to log in, how to register, all them kind of fun things. Just, you have to register for this event, though, because it's bound to be popular. So just drop us an email if you want to come along on the 18th of November, rnabni@rnib.org.uk. And we shall, if you keep an eye on our social media channels, we'll be releasing more details of that very, very shortly. The RNIB Christmas Open Day on the 2nd of December. Great opportunity to come down to the Victoria House office here, 10 a.m., 4 p.m, 2nd December. It's a Tuesday, I believe. Get hands-on with some products, get all those all-important Christmas gift ideas. There might even be a Christmas quiz and some live music, I believe, from very vocally talented RNAB staff. Last year was a great success. Good buzz in the room. Come on down if you can make it. Also, just reminding you of the RNAB NI Tech Fair 26, 11th of February. There's a pre-registration link now on our social media. Last year, some of the feedback we got was that, you know, it took too long to get registered to get in through the door. This time, we've decided there's a pre-registration link, so feel free to go on there. Tell us you're coming, click the link, fill in a few questions, and you won't have to do that on the day. Yay. As always, if you want to get in touch with us, please do. We love to hear your comments, suggestions, feedback. Just email rnabni@rnab.org.uk. If you want to send something directly to our campaigns team, our campaigns and policy guys, just email campaignsni@rnab.org.uk. You can always phone the RNAB helpline, as always, on 0303 123 9999. And please do tell your friends, tell your enemies, tell everybody you know about the podcast. We're building slowly, guys. The figures are looking good. We've had a couple of hundred people listening so far, which is brilliant, and thank you so much indeed. Next month we're going to focus a bit more on Christmas and RNAB Products and Advice Centre here in Belfast. We might have a couple of guests on. Who knows what else we might do? There's another couple of ideas I've got bubbling around in my brain, but if you've got an idea about Christmas, let me know. But yeah, thank you so much indeed for listening, guys, and we'll see you all again next month. Thank you very much.
RNIB. See differently.